I'm Tom Downing.
I'm Adam DiCarlo.
And welcome to Before the Break, a podcast for actors
by actors.
Brought to you by Working Actor Pro.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Before the Break. I am joined by special guest host Julian Gavilanes. This week, we have a special writer strike episode. Our guest today is an actor, director, producer, and writer. Most recently, he was a staff writer on season 3 of the Max series, The Other Two. Please welcome to the show, Dylan Guerra.
Hey. Oh, my last name is pronounced Guerra, actually. Fun fact.
Get out, Adam. You're fired.
We're just gonna, yeah. I'm Dylan just Guerra. Welcome to the show, Dylan Guerra.
Hey, fuck what's me. Up?
Hey,
thanks
Dylan.
For having me.
Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. You know what? Day 87 today of the strike. Okay. But I'm good. You know, the heat wave's happening, so it's a time where we're going to talk about a lot of things, but something I want to like preach about energy bills just to start here for the summer.
Oh my God.
If
please
you
do.
Are turning off your AC when you leave your apartment, you're doing it wrong. You have to turn your AC up because you spend the most amount of energy. Your AC spends the most amount of energy cooling your apartment. So if you keep your apartment at a low cool, it'll actually save you money on your energy bill than turning it off entirely. How fun is that?
So what do you mean? You mean like if you turn it to like 72 instead of 68?
Yeah, or like 76 when you leave. Yeah, you'll save money.
Fun 76 fact. Seems a little warm. 76 seems a little warm for my blood.
That's a little warm. It is warm, but...
Dylan Guerra here for that.
Yeah,
that energy bill.
I didn't know I was gonna go there today.
Look, that's important. People, I have like $600 energy bills, so like I'm trying.
God.
That.
Yeah, it's,
what? I have a dog, so absurd. We kind of always just have to.
Yeah,
hang on.
No, I want a dog. Yeah. Ugh, I'm also shopping for a dog. Adopt.
Nice. Oh wow,
hey, puppy.
Perfect. What's your dog's name?
Bentley.
Sweet. Aww.
We've had him for 2 years now.
Wow. Wow, yeah, I want a little beagle mix, and I've been going to the adoption centers and looking online.
Nice. Yeah, it took us like a year to get him because, well, that would have been like the summer of COVID. So it was just everyone in New York City was like, oh, well, we're not doing anything. Let's get a dog.
Looking for a companion.
It was fucking crazy. It took a year to like secure a dog.
Yeah.
Anyway. Getting off topic. Dylan, thank you so much for joining us. Normally, you know, when we have industry guests, it's like casting directors and agents, and we've had an intimacy coordinator, which was a great episode, or like a headshot photographer, but we've never had a writer on the show, and it seemed pertinent given what's going on in the industry right now. And before we do get into like the strike and all of that, you know, Julian and I, on like the acting side, we know how you get a job, right? It's, you know, might take a few years to like get some representation.
Hardly.
But then, yeah, I know, right? But at the end of the day, you essentially take a test, which is like the audition process, and you prepare for that.
Yeah.
But like in the writing world, you're a staff writer. We're a staff writer for an HBO show. How in the world do you get to that? Like, how do you prove yourself to other writers or the network? Or, like, how do you secure a job like that?
Yeah. In lieu of, like, coming down from the mountaintop and saying, like, this is how I did it or this is how you do it, I think I'm just going to share – it might be kind of long-winded, but I'm going to share the story of, like, how I got on The Other Two because I was actually just – I also like teach writing. And I was just doing like teaching a class and we were talking about career trajectories, and it's like, you can kind of trace a line. Like I kind of have like a very neat line trace of how I wound up on The Other Two. So I primarily come from theater. I've worked mostly in theater throughout my career. And I have done like the fellowship circuit and all of that stuff with playwriting. And when I moved to New York, I was writing these like really shitty plays that I thought it was 2016. The world was changing. Like people did not know what they wanted to see. It was sort of like trying to talk directly about the time, but that's sort of, my writing is very like more surrealist and weird and strange. And then this solo performer who I knew, I know we're going like to downtown theater to get to the other two.
Please.
This solo performer that used to come and do workshops in my undergrad class, his name is Tim Miller. He's like a very, I love him dearly. He's like, was a big downtown solo performance artist. He now lives in LA. He's awesome. He's like, he was like very popular in like 90s, early aughts. And, he was teaching a solo performance workshop that he had done at SMU, which is where I went to school, at this small theater called Dixon Place. It's a cultural staple of like downtown, like performance art theater, which wasn't exactly where I like existed in theater world. I kind of did the internship circuit and was trying to like really hit hard in the off-Broadway markets. And I did this solo performance workshop with him. He asked me to co-facilitate it with him, as in he was going to be the head teacher, but I was the person that had sort of done it before and was going to be around. And I, at the end, we all did like 5-minute solo pieces. And I did this 5-minute solo piece where I cast people in the audience as people that I went on failed dates with, men I went on failed dates with. And then I ran around the stage with them and I apologized to them. It was very like 23, just moved to New York. Or maybe at this point I was like 24, and I apologized to them, and then we like lied on the floor together and we just like sat in silence. Anyway, very like not totally exactly what I do. It was very like whatever, but the artistic director of the theater came up to me and she was like, we have this festival called Hot Fest. It's a queer arts festival. And we had a solo performer drop out kind of last minute. Do you have an hour long version of something like this that you can do for us?
And I
an hour long. And I was like, yes. And I fully did it. So I called my best friend.
I was like, did you really?
No. I called my best friend who's a director. And I was like, this is going to be weird, but we have an hour long solo shot at the festival. At the same time, I had been casually dating this guy. This is all going to connect to the other two like so soon. I probably.
It's great.
I had been casually dating, like casually seeing this guy. And he, it was like this weird relationship where he would call me over to his apartment at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I would think that we were going to like, you know, have sex or something. But instead, he would just like tell me swaths of things that he was going through from his life. And I sort of became his like weird night nurse therapist. One night he told me, this is while I'm doing the solo performance workshop, or maybe it's like the solo performance workshop came like right after.
You said, can I do a show about you?
No, you I did not ask. No, it's weirder than that. He one night he started crying and he told me that he was going to disappear. And then I never saw him again. And he had moved everything out of his apartment and he completely went missing, but like not police investigation missing. Like I'm assuming his family knew where he was, but no one, like we had mutual friends. No one knew like what had happened to him. And he was suddenly just like gone in the middle of the night. So when this solo show came in,
how is Kevin Spacey doing?
I know, right? It's so weird. My best friend, I called my best friend. I was like, what if for the solo show, I tried to earnestly find this guy? And so I did a like 2-month investigation up until literally like the night before I did the solo show for the first time, where I interviewed previous men that I had dated to see if it was me. I interviewed like people that kind of knew him, people that had met him, but I compiled this solo show called Find Him. And I did it at this festival and it went really well. And then I did it at the Duplex, at like a cabaret space. Mm-hmm. And then Ars Nova got wind of it and it got selected for their all new talent festival, their Amp Fest, which is like a life changing thing that I did. And then from there, Ars Nova picked it up and I did it off Broadway like once a month for like 6 months. And then in the pandemic, Whoa. They commissioned me to turn it into a 4-part docuseries. And while I was working on that, I was like, well, what if I turn this into a pilot? And sort of through the show and through like other things in my playwriting life, I had gotten TV and literary representation. And I turned it into this pilot called Find Him. And it's really wackadoodle, crazy town. And it was sort of the thing that made me feel like I was finally selfishly writing for myself. And it was something that was just like for me. And then my agents were sending it out. I had a couple of meetings for different staffing things that wound up not panning out. And then my manager called me and he was like, hey, I want to send this to Chris and Sarah Schneider. They're casting or they're staffing for the other two. And it sounds like they might want somebody that has been involved in theater. And I was like, well, that sounds like me. And I'd watched the first season of the other two and I loved it. My mom is in town. It's my mom's birthday. They send it to Chris and Sarah. My manager sends it to Chris and Sarah on a Friday morning. I get a call Friday afternoon that they want to have a meeting with me Friday night. I have not yet watched season two. It is my mom's birthday. And I'm like,
that's a quick turnaround.
It was very quick turnaround. And I was like, Mom, I'm so sorry. We have to cancel all your plans. We have to sit down and we have to watch season two of the other two right now, the reason why I had not watched season two is because I have this thing where if I really love a show, I will not watch it. Like, it's just like, if I really love something, it takes me forever to watch it. Cause I'm like, I have to be in the right mood. It has to be the right moment. All the candles have to be lit. The tarot cards have to say it's time for me to watch it. So I pushed the meeting to Saturday morning. I met with Chris and Sarah at like 10 a.m. on the Saturday morning. That Wednesday, I found out I had the job. The following week was off for Thanksgiving. And the day after Thanksgiving, I was on a flight to L.A. and in the writer's room. So from getting the call that they were getting sent my work to me day one in the writer's room was like 2.5 weeks. Wow. So it was very very whirlwindy. I was like I do CrossFit. I was at the gym and I had a call from I had a missed call from every assistant and every agent that like reps me. which so it was 100 because I have a huge no. It was like my I'm just kidding. It was like my manager, my manager's assistant, my agent's assistant, and then like theater agent, my theater agent's assistant. And I had like all these.
So a bit like acting in that your reps send your work out to people who they get wind are looking for things.
Totally. You know, I think if we're talking about like, wow, sorry, I'm looking at how long we've been live for and I'm like, wow, I really just rambled for 10 minutes.
No, man, it's a great story. It gives perfect context.
Oh, thank you. I think like the touch point for both actors and writers is that it is a lot of like, you know, my version of a self-tape is sending out my pilot to somebody and having a general meeting. Like that is our version of the self-tape. And then it sort of becomes, usually the other two is sort of a fluke, but for other things that I've worked on or gotten close to, it usually goes like general meeting with the production company. And then they are aware of the show that's happening. And then they send the production company sends your work to the showrunners. And then you'll have like a meeting with the showrunner. So usually there's like two meetings before you meet the showrunners. And with my case, with the other two, I sort of just went straight to Chris and Sarah. But it is sort of self-tape. I'd say like in my percent, and I, you know, I mean, Adam, you and I are in an episode of the other two together, which is that's how we first met. It's very cute.
You and the lead were talking and I was like, oh, do you guys know each other? And you were like, I work on the show. And I was like, oh, wait, what? You're like, I'm a staff writer. I was like, oh, awesome. Yeah. I was like, you guys seem to like know each other.
Yeah. Well that's weirdly, Drew Tarver, who is Carrie in the other two, one of his best friends is also a writer on the other two. And her and I got really close in the room. And so I like while we were writing the show, I formed the friendship with Drew that sort of felt outside of other two world because it was kind of like comedy and bars. but I'd say it's for me a difference between like the self-tape and the sending in a script model is like, you know, obviously they have to like your work, but then we have a meeting, and I think something that I'm really thankful for, and something that I've come to find more with TV writing in particular, is that I feel like they're getting to know my personhood in a way, you know, because like when I had my meeting with Chris and Sarah, for example, like we didn't just talk about the show. We also kind of talked about our lives to see if there was like, well, we want to be working together. And I do, in my limited experience in acting, I do sort of wish that like when you got to a certain phase of auditioning, they were like, let's take you out for a drink and get to know you now. You know, and like,
I mean, especially if you're going to be like a regular. We've talked it on this show 100 times about, you know, somebody who like maybe auditioned for a show and it was truly meant to be one episode. And they were like, great, I did my day, I did my guest star, whatever. And then 2 months go by and their rep is like, hey, actually, so-and-so called and they want you back. They really liked you.
Yeah.
And so many people have come back. And then they, you know, they might be on a show with 25 episodes under their belt. And they'll be like, to be totally honest, I was very nice. I showed up. I did my job. And I just got along with everybody.
Totally.
And we have said, like, look, when you're on like a big, like, let's just say hour-long show that's 22 episodes, that's like 9 months of shooting with insane hours. Outside in the cold, if you're here in New York, outside in the heat, and you want to work with people who you get on with, because then you might have people who are assholes and you're like, oh, you know, it's a long, long, hard shoot.
Totally.
So it's important that, especially with the cast, you are surrounded by people who people like working with. And so it's like that should be, you know, a part of it. It's like, we really like your work, but before we hire you, let's go hang real quick and make sure that you don't suck.
Totally. I agree. I mean, I agree 100%. It's funny. I mean, especially now that we're talking about, I'm not trying to move the conversation completely into strike world just yet, but like the strike is contextualized, I think. And you guys will feel this when you hit day 85, but the strike has contextualized a lot of, I think, what it means to work in this field, because I think, and this is something that I've been really passionate about from an organizational standpoint, but I think one of the most surreal feelings has been the sort of loneliness that comes with not working. Like, I didn't even realize how much my day-to-day was so dependent on the conversations that I was having with the people I was working with, the people I was developing shows with, the staff writers of the other two. Granted, you know, the show ended, so we weren't doing a season 4, but you know, if as a thought experiment, like if we were, like how much the entertainment industry does literally rely on these connections between people. And so picket lines have sort of become not just this like necessity of getting through this strike, of getting the fair contract, of shutting down production, but it's also a necessity for us to like
socialize
and be with people and share space and be like, yo, we're getting through this. Or like, hey, like you worked, you know, I one of the most surreal things was day one of the strike. I won a playwriting competition when I was like 16 in Miami, and it's where I'm from. And I got to work with this playwright, Lisa Cron, who wrote Fun Home. And we like really bonded, and she was the first person to tell me that I should take playwriting seriously as a profession. And she like is sort of one of those people that just absolutely changed my life. And day one, first picket, first person I run into on the picket line is her. And I was like, this is the most, I mean, instantly I was like, and I'm like, I say I'm not like a very sappy person, but I am like the probably like the most like give everybody a present on the last day of filming and like cry and then be like, hey, hang out. And everyone's like, we're friends, like it's fine, like we're friends. But that moment just instantly made me feel like, oh shit, my mentor's here. You know, like my mentor's in this.
When are all these people on the street at the same time together?
I know, exactly. And it's so there crazy. Is a sort of, I have
also like, I feel like it really contextualizes the community that exists within, especially as a writer, because it's so isolated to like, well, typically, especially if you're like not in a writer's room, but even if so, you're still working with X amount of people. And if you, when you go out to those picket lines, you're like, oh yeah, we're all in this shit together. This is so cool. I was out there day one and I was like, I probably saw like 15 people that I have worked with over the course of my career. And it was so cool because I like remembered that I was an actor in that moment. You forget, yeah. You forget that like when you're in this business, that you're even in this business, because so, you know, inconsistent when it is, and you're just kind of like flying around kind of like, where am I going? What am I doing? And then I was there, and obviously the circumstances suck, but it was incredible. It was really inspiring. And it's like, oh yeah, this is my community. These are my people. And then you're just chatting, walking around in a circle, and you're having conversations with all these people that you've worked with. And I was crying, man. It was like really, really special.
It is.
And it continues to be.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of those things that gets harder and harder as, you know, it's hard to see. We're in this period where it's like, it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel as far as when are we going to get out of this? It's not hard to see, like, you know, I do believe that we will both SAG and the WGA will win. And I think we will get the majority of what we are asking for, because it is true that like they need us more than we need them. Like, granted, they are the financiers, they are the way that we get paid, but they literally can't, their entire industry hinges on what we do for them. And so knowing that that sort of, that the, not to be like, so like Game of Thronesy about it, but like the scales of power are tipped in our balance or tipped in our favor is, while they are continually trying to take power from us, is an interesting, I don't think there's anything more to say other than that, as far as like how I feel about the powers that be, but you know, I have a lot of faith that we're going to get through this. And I think, Julian, you're absolutely right that like it does necessitate this like emotional connection, this like running into people, this reminder. I love hearing like, it reminded me that I'm an actor. It's like, I hear that. Like, it reminds me that I don't know about your, like where y'all come from and stuff, but I've referred to myself for a really long time. This is actually hilariously, to talk about the other two briefly, but like, I refer to myself as a shitty little rat all the time. And then it's the way, because I did this solo show but I also was like self-producing a lot of my plays at these like off Broadway, like downtown dusty basement theaters.
On
like
a bridge.
Grounding on a bridge.
Literally, yeah. On a bridge.
And like trying to get my life together. And so I referred to myself as like a scrappy, shitty little rat all the time. It was just like my, like in the trenches doing the things. And then like being out on these picket lines for me personally, and like being part of a show that people really seem to like, and sort of feeling like my voice is being heard, has made the strike, in a way, has made me have to lean into that more, to say like, I actually deserve better. Which is not like, I think for a lot of queer artists, I think that's not sort of the default, you know, like, I don't think that the default is to say, cause we fight so fucking hard just to get whatever, you know, to get
totally
baseline rights, you know, like we fight right. So hard to get just like baseline, you're allowed to exist, that like, pushing past that and saying, actually, like, even with that, like the way that I'm being treated in my industry is unfair. Like, it does take a lot of putting yourself on the line. So without the communal support, and SAG's been there from the beginning of the strike, and that was also from the beginning of the writer's strike, and like that's been monumental for us. And so
it's great. I don't know if you're anything like,
yes,
me, but I feel
tears,
like
tears. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if you're anything like me, Dylan, but like, I, you know, you work so hard to do something with yourself and in your career as an artist in this realm. And you get to a certain place with it and you immediately feel kind of like an imposter, right? Imposter syndrome sets in. That's why you call yourself a dirty little rat. You're just like, yeah, like I, half the time I just tell people I'm in finance because I don't want the follow-up question of like, well, what have we seen you in? Because it's just like, shut the fuck up.
What restaurant do you work at?
Yeah. You know, it's just so like demoralizing a lot of times because of people's perception to the world that you live in. And if you can't associate yourself to being Mission Impossible 37 with Tom Cruise in the coolest scene, they're like, I don't know what you do then. And it doesn't really matter. And so, but I think that ultimately creates this like, imposter syndrome to be like, well, why am I here? Like, I'm not recognizable. I'm not this thing. I'm not this XYZ. But ultimately it's like, oh, fuck that, man. I've worked so hard to be in this position and I deserve it. And again, like what you're saying, it's just like, now you're in these lines with these people and they're like giving you hugs and you're being reminded of like this wealth of work that you've done over the course of your career. And like, that's right. That's totally. Right. I am here. I am worth being here. I am valuable to this business. But that imposter syndrome is a real bitch, man. How have you like navigated that for yourself and like gotten away from it?
I feel like I'm always sort of in some ways navigating imposter syndrome, both from being mixed race and also from just being like a queer person, also from being an artist.
Sure.
But it's just sort of like it's like, whoa, where's the representation? But I think like something that I do that helps me from a writing standpoint, I like will invite friends over to just hear things out loud, whether it's my writing or another friend's writing, like doesn't matter, but just like literally like building your own community so that in moments of pause, you know, and then we can connect to the strike hard here. And I'm going to launch into something that I'm deeply passionate about with the strike.
Launch.
And I feel like isn't getting the press. Thank you. I will launch. It's also, I like have 100,000 questions for you guys. I was staffed on the other two from November of 2021 through April of 2022, right? And then post that, I had a couple of theater obligations, so I wasn't quite looking to be staffed again. And then around like August, I had been looking to staff. And I've had so many meetings, but I haven't worked on a show. Like, I haven't worked in another writer's room since the other two, which is like we literally just got an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Writing.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's Chris and Darren's, but it's cool to be part of. And
imposter syndrome, man. You're part of that.
Yeah, true. But, and also like, it's like a beloved comedy in the industry. And yet I couldn't get another job, which like, made me feel like I was probably a monster to my reps because I was like calling them being like, what am I doing wrong? Like, what is wrong with me? And they're like, there's nothing wrong with you. And then I got staffed twice from the other two, but none of them went through because the budget for the room, it was basically meetings with showrunners that were like, we want to hire you. We're waiting for the budget to come through for what the writer's room is. And essentially the budget came through from whoever in the AMPTP that converted the room into a mini room. So for people that are listening that don't know how mini room structures work or how writer's room structures work, writer's rooms usually are a standard of like 8 to 12 writers. You get more like 12 on like your more like network procedural that has many, many episodes in the season. But between 8 to 12 writers writing for anywhere between like 20 weeks to like the most I've seen is like that I've seen in my limited experience is like six. I had a friend that was in a room for like 6 months, I think, for like a network procedural. But mini rooms basically are 7 writers or less, 10 to 15 weeks. So like the other two was 7 writers at 15 weeks. I'm actually not sure that the other two constitutes as a tried and true mini room because of other prerogatives that were in place there. But so what's essentially happening is that writers' rooms are getting smaller with the same amount of content. And what the AMPTP is saying is like, with a Netflix streamer where it's 10 episodes, an hour each, like, do you need the same amount of time as a network procedural like, and this is not being shady to them at all, but like Law and Order, that sort of has its formula and has its form that it's going and cuts out what, like 24 episodes a season or something like that?
22 is usually the standard.
But when you're thinking about it, it's like, well, an hour long, no commercial breaks for a prestige market, trying, like, Netflix very saying, like, we're trying to elevate this to, like, be an awards contender. Like, that takes a tremendous amount of work. But more than that, more than, like, just, like, the nitty-gritty of that aside, the way that that we're structured for in the guild, and a way that I think is a really wonderful way to be structured, is that it goes staff writer, story editor, executive story editor, co-producer, producer, executive producer. There's maybe some other things in there, but that's like sort of the ladder up. And each one comes with a pay bump and eventually an episode guarantee. And the pay bumps are significant, and you're all in a room together. And for the most part, you all share the same amount of responsibility. It's just a way of, you know, building your career and also having job security. But with mini rooms, when a showrunner is presented, especially a new time showrunner is presented with, you can hire 7 writers. Usually it's like 6 or 5 these days, especially for like new series. A first time showrunner, an early showrunner, they're going to have to pick people from the producer level. They're not going to get through the full ladder, the full swath of. So a lot of people that are at the story editor and staff writer tier are getting cut from writer's rooms, which is what happened to me, where like I was going to be hired at a story editor level, but before that contract even came out, before the final offer was there, the budget changed and it didn't just like cut me, it removed my entire position from the writer's room. And then when you take that and you extrapolate it to right now, we all know that our TV and film world, a lot of industries are gatekept, right? Which meant that a lot of queer people, a lot of people of color, a lot of women didn't have the same opportunities as the straight white man did in film and
Thanks TV. A lot, Julian.
Yeah, no problem, you fuck faces. Yeah,
get out of here. No.
I'm gay now.
Hey. Some people are doing not to be shady, but some people are.
Look, that's a major disservice to the whole community.
Can I get a leg up? Talk to your reps. Yeah. Just start submitting me for anything gay.
But it's gatekept. So we're in also a boom of people of color, queer people getting the ability to tell stories for the first time, but what's happening is that we're getting shut out of these writers' rooms before we're able to build our career, because we're at this story editor, we're at the staff writer level, and we're not able to move up because they can't take a risk on bumping us all the way to producer when we don't have that experience. And then how that extra affects it is, and I'll use myself as an example, Find Him is a show, is in development with a production company that I'm not going to name. And I'm not going to name like out of like solidarity for strike stuff. And they have been wonderful. And we took it out to network and they had an overall, and basically it got passed on because it was, it's a show that was starring me. That was I had to be the head writer and showrunner because it was an autobiographical project. And no one was willing to take the chance because I didn't have the resume bolstering. And this is happening to a lot of people. So
no one wants to say yes until someone else has said yes.
Totally.
And it's like when you don't have your first TV credit as an actor, you're like in this really weird gray area, because it's like everyone's just going, well, they've never been on TV before.
Totally.
Like we don't know that they even know what being on a fucking set is like.
Totally. 100%.
And then once you do get like your first credit, there is a bit more of a door open of people go, oh yeah, they know what it's like. They've been on a set. Doesn't matter but like they at least have the experience, and it just sort of gets the ball rolling. But
yes.
Many times, like when you're first starting, no one wants to say yes to you until they have seen that other people have, because it's, I mean, it is a trust thing and it's a lot of money on the line in most cases.
Totally.
You know, shit's expensive.
Yeah. And just like, and just the way that just to touch back in many rooms, and then I have a question for both of you, but the way that that we're unable to tell our story, like, I think what I would like for people that are, that have questions about the strike, that are just like, writers want more money. I'm also like, it's also, it actually is also a fight about making sure that you, that, that people are represented right on screens. Like, that is actually also something that is in this fight. It's just
totally,
you know, I had to talk about in order to get that point across, which is just like not the most marketable thing in the world, but it is like the strike, it is so much more than money. It's also about, you know, I know for SAG, a big one is like health insurance. It's also a healthcare issue. It is also, it is also a representation issue. Like there are so many moving components of things that we're fighting for in this. And then of course, like, I don't even want to talk about AI. I'm so sick of it. Okay. What you were talking about, I do have a question for you of what were both of your first TV things that you did?
Unforgettable.
What was that experience? What?
The on set, mine was Unforgettable. It was on A&E.
Oh, cool.
Oddly, the director of the episode was in the room when I auditioned, which like never happens.
Wow.
And so went in and I had sort of prepared it one way. It was just a one line co-star thing. I give the villain of the week something that like he created, whatever. And she goes, "Oh, just so you know, information. And I was like, "Oh, okay, give me like 1 second." And I like changed the line read because that informed. She goes, "You just made this and you're so proud of it." And I was like, "Oh, great. That's not in the, I would never know that." And so I did it a different way with like a little bit more pride. And she goes, "Boom, that was it. Perfect." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And she goes, "I'm not going to lie. One-line auditions are the fucking worst. They are the hardest thing to cast because it's just, it's so little and you're, you know," and she was like, "Anyway, that was perfect. Let's just do it one more time just to like have it." And she goes, "Well, that was pretty, that's it. I have no notes." And I was like, "Thank you." And I leave and I'm like, "Did I get that?" Like,
yeah.
I've never heard that in a room. So a whole week goes by and then I did get it. But the whole week I was like, "Oh fuck, maybe I didn't. Maybe somebody else did the same thing I did." And then on set, of course, they like called me in 2 hours before my call time because they were running ahead of schedule. So I hear my phone ring as I'm in the shower and they were like, "You need to be here right now." And I'm like, okay. And they're like, "Even take an Uber." I was like, "I live in Brooklyn. That's just going to take way too long." So I do eventually get there. And of course I get there and they're like, "And now wait."
Yeah, of course.
And the two leads and the guest star were in an office building. I have to like walk down this long office and then hit them right on a certain line with the prop thing. But it's so far away. There's no way on earth I can hear anything they're saying. So it's like, how do we cue when I need to start walking, so by the time I land, it's in the dialogue for it to be my line? So we do this so many times. And then we had like a PA who was going to tap my shoulder, who was also listening in, blah, 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 blah. And it took a few times. And none of it was, you know, my fault. It's so far away. I literally can't hear any of the dialogue. So how do we like cue my bit? So the director, she was like getting mad at everybody and she was, you know, but yeah, that was, I was there for maybe 2 hours.
Wow.
So easy. It was like from noon to two. And I was like, I just made that much money in 2 hours.
Yeah.
Woo. Yeah. Awesome. And then I was wrapped
for the whole year.
yeah. And then I wrapped and they went to lunch and I was like, well, I'm still getting lunch out of this. So, Yeah, that was my first TV experience.
That's awesome.
Julian, what was yours?
Yeah. I had a couple in Seattle where I'm from originally before, but when I moved out to New York, it took a jiffy before I started booking any work. I booked the show Mr. Robot, and it so happened that it was their first episode that they were like, I think it's just attempting to like win an Emmy for the episode itself, because they were trying to accomplish like the one track shot for like the episode, the whole episode.
Yes.
And it was the first time that was being done on network television, because it was like a USA show and they had never done it in like cable. And it's a very specific set. It's a very like calculated, like show itself really like feels like how the set feels. It's intense. And so, you know, the way that they do that is they take like 8-9 minute segments and shoot the whole entire thing, and they stitch those segments together. I didn't know this coming on. All I knew was that I was just like playing some douchebag, because that's what I do. And I had this, you know, relatively small scene with Rami Malek. And so I was excited about it, but little did I know that it was actually at the very end. It was the last piece at the end of this like 9 minute segment. And it's all.
Oh my God. The pressure of just not fucking that up.
Dude, it was so crazy. It was so, so stressful, because it's very. I only had like 6 lines, man, but it's so funny, because if I watch that back, like all I can see in my like in my like internal monologue is just like, don't fuck this up, because they had to take the camera had to come up and reset from like the very bottom of this building, and then I'm at the top of the building like in the office. I'm some like office bro that's like dealing with some stuff and has to deal with Rami while he tries to accomplish this thing. And so they start on the ground level of like Park Avenue or whatever, and he comes into the elevator and moves around. There's all this choreography, and he has this like inner earpiece in that he's getting his like internal monologue from. If you guys have seen the show, he like talks to himself and is doing this whole dance, and he has to like get up the stairs and then get away from a security guard and over here and come over there. Finally, he gets up to the top, and he does his thing, and he gets to the lady before me. And the lady, he's like walking around this office, and this poor lady, man, she's like 75 years old, and she's so sweet. I don't know how many experiences on television she's ever had in her life, but she's meant to just like be like this quirky old woman, kind of like at her cubicle sniffing glue. And she was like playing it really hard, like, and Sam Esmail, the director and writer showrunner, comes out, and he's like, hey, like, we got to reset. This is like, you don't need to do that. It can just be like a very subtle sniff. It's not, you don't need to like lean into it so much. So sure enough, they go back and they reset. They do it 3 more times. And this woman is like right before they like continue to push camera towards me. And so I'm just sitting there like waiting, like, oh my God, this is going to come. But she keeps leaning into this moment.
I love finger
glue. And to the point where Sam's like angry, and he's like coming out and like, hey, listen, like I'm going to like, just cut you out of this completely. If you can't just give the fucking thing like a little, like, it's just like just sniff it, just fucking sniff it. And poor lady, she was just like, we're all nervous, man. We're all just have a few lines here. Like, fuck, what are we gonna do? Like, she gets through it, and I'm like, she's gonna fuck. And honestly, it made me feel so good, because I was like, the pressure is taken off of me in this moment. and so eventually, like, she gets it, and they start coming to me, and I'm just like, oh fuck, I'm gonna fucking say the right line. I'm like, genuinely, like, those however many lines there were just were gone. But somehow they were just like came out of me somehow while I'm thinking, don't fuck this up. And I got through it, and it worked, and it was like, all right, we're done with that segment. And it's just like, fuck, man, I almost like shit my pants and vomited and fucking like died in this moment, just in sheer panic of like,
I know,
not messing this up. And it was like, you know, you're already nervous if it in any type of set, but if it's something that they have to reset and do like, you know, like a whole situation with,
yeah,
it was scary. But yeah, that was one of my first experiences.
That's amazing. I love that your first experience was a massive one take shot. That's yeah, really good.
And the very
welcome
end
to TV, kid.
Yeah, it
was,
yeah, truly.
It was gnarly.
I was thinking about what you were saying about imposter syndrome, and I do have another imposter syndrome moment.
Yeah, sweet.
So I had been a big fan of Chris and Sarah for a really long time before day one of the other two writers' room, and everything felt so whirlwindy. I had like hardly any time to I was visiting family in Orlando for Thanksgiving, and then the next night, like, you know, like a big black van came and picked me up, you know, like it was very like in like an Orlando suburb, and I was like, woo, like what is happening? And then like flying first class to LA, and I was just like, what? I did truly black out on the flight on champagne because I was like so nervous. And then like a car picked me up and took me to my hotel, and the hotel was like, we upgraded you to a penthouse, and I was like, this is so
insane.
My dad is a stand-up comedian, chill, and my mom is a improv actor in Miami, and so
what,
in a very like hippie liberal artsy partsy family, so then to suddenly be like shuttling first class, and it was just like such a like insane moment. And I was truly like having, I was like in heaven, of course, but I was also like on the verge of a panic attack for like the first time in my life.
Also, then, they have the money to do all that shit, but they can't pay you to do your fucking job. Like,
no, exactly. Totally. God. 100%. So then they know what they're doing. They treat you just nice enough. And then so then it's day one. We're meeting. We were writing out of Broadway video offices in LA. And so like we're at like Lorne Michaels' office, you know, where he has like so many pictures of his kids everywhere. And I was just like, oh my God, this is crazy. This is just like the craziest day of my life. And I'm meeting like my comedy heroes. And also like Alison Silverman is in the room, who like, if you're listening to this, just like IMDb her. She's written on literally every show. Jimmy Fallon was in it. And like, we love him. It was just like all of these comedy people. And I, for a separate podcast another day, I had so many insecurities about working in comedy. Anyway, I'm getting the imposter syndrome part and how I worked through it. So then Chris is like, we're all going to go to dinner tonight. I was at the end of day one. Like, we're all going to go to dinner. It's our first like really get to know you dinner. And we go to this like fancy restaurant. And I'm like, I don't know what to do in this situation at like one of the nicest restaurants I'd ever been to, like meeting all of these people, being like, I come from theater, you know, like I can go to your own basement, being like, I sound like Dobby. And then I looked on the menu and I was like, I'm ordering rabbit. How I'm gonna get through this is I'm gonna order rabbit, because that sounds to me like what you do if you are powerful, as you order like,
oh my God,
eat rabbit.
Can you put the caviar on the rabbit?
Exactly. And then the rabbit came out and I ate it, and I hated it. I do not like rabbit at all, and I'm like force feeding rabbit to myself. Meanwhile, like, everybody is so chill and so great, and like, there was no reason for me other than my own, you know, my own shit to not, to have this imposter. Like, it was fully me. That's actually like when we ended the room.
Still wasted from the plane. Just
wasted from the plane.
Compare that to San Diego. So silly.
Yeah. But just like, to me, like the end of, I guess, like my old insecure self of writer's room is so synonymous with like shoveling like a $45 rabbit meal into my mouth and trying to be like a person while everybody else is just totally normal.
Yeah.
yeah, that's the imposter syndrome's real. It's real.
A, it's it's interesting how it happens and how you navigate that stuff. But I think it's pretty typical for most people, especially when they're coming up, especially as an artist. It's like, it's an artist, it's so subject to like who you are and what you've done and what, like, what you're capable of doing, what you're capable of giving. And I think when you're especially trying to be impressionable, it's almost like you're having that moment with the rap. You're like you have this moment inside your head where you're like, I don't even fucking like rapping. I don't even know why I'm doing this. What the fuck am I doing? Why am I fucking doing this? You're like, you know, probably trying to like pair it with a nice fucking red wine or something you know nothing about either, but you're just, and then you look around at the table and the people that are seasoned are just chilling, eating a fucking dang quesadilla or whatever, and they're just like, dude, fuck it.
Yeah.
But it's so funny too, because it's like there's a
but it's like a duck of, quesadilla.
Yeah. It's like it's kind of charming on one hand, but mostly because it's just transparent. Like they can see right through that and be like, oh, poor kid, you know, he's just trying to like, you know, make his mark here and be cool. But it's interesting how like you have to go through that to get to the other side and acknowledge that that is happening, to be like, oh yeah, that's not important anymore. I don't need to totally feel that way.
And then,
the next job comes and you feel the same fucking way again. And you're like, oh totally. Shit,
that's
this
what
is just
saying.
A continuous thing. Yeah. This is a continuous thing that I need to like, cause every single experience changes and you have to kind of like figure out how to work through it every single time. And so there is no formula. There's no way that you're like, okay, so this is how it happens on every single job. It's all different. And it's like, so
totally. I mean, tough. I have a friend who got staffed on a show, literally got staffed on a show. I'm not going to name them, got staffed on a show because they were making Facebook posts about their like life, and then one of them went viral, and then that became a like pilot that they wrote that then got that, like, it is, there is like no, there's no real math, which like the thing that I'll like always champion is like, you just gotta put your shit out there. Like, it's so hard. Like, the process of putting yourself on the line like is so hard, and then once you're like on the line, you're sort of like, okay, I'm doing it, you know, because I mean, I'm sure, Julian, that like at the end of that shoot, when you guys finally nailed that 9-minute take, it probably felt electric. You know, like I can remember second to the rabbit is the first time that I said a joke that like Chris and Sarah were like, oh, let's walk that through, which is just like, you know, let's walk through what that joke would look like if it was on the show. And it wound up not, it wound up not being cut, but it was the first thing that I had said where it was like, oh, that was valuable and helpful, and we're doing it. And I was like, oh my, what is this power from my fingertips?
You know, like, yeah.
Or like remembering, you're like tossing around Ann Dowd's name in the room, and then seeing Ann Dowd in the show is like, whoa, that is crazy. That can just happen. And then it's like, well, yeah, Ann Dowd is also just a person. She also probably deals with imposter syndrome. She's also trying to get a job.
And also,
yeah, totally.
A paycheck is a paycheck is a paycheck is a paycheck.
Totally.
Well, and now we're all. Well, I think the reality of it all, and something that, you know, is very humbling, is that, you know, at least in that experience of mine, it wrapped, and it was like, okay, shot's done, and it was electric in that moment, and I was like, yeah, felt like, you know, it's my first TV gig in New York. I'm a fucking real actor. This is incredible, man. I'm gonna get paid $2. I'm fucking awesome. And then it's like, oh, that's a wrap on Julian and goodbye. And I'm like, oh, cool. Like, well, hey, Randy, you want to fucking, we're buds now, right? Like, we're going to hang out. And like, nobody cares. Nobody knows anything. Like, they, you know, you walk off set and I'm just like, I remember like being completely off and like out of my outfit and back on the street. And I was like,
and now I'm unemployed.
Well,
again.
I guess I got to go to my bartending job tonight now.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's so real, man. It was just like, and then the highs and lows of that experience, you know, then that night you're like dealing with customers kind of like screaming at you to give them a fucking Long Island iced tea or something. And you're like, oh, man. And part of me wants to be like, do you even fucking have an idea where I was today? Do you know what I have been doing? And it's like, dude, no, you can't. Nobody fucking gives a shit. And reality is that just like nobody cares. You know, like I built up like 9 hours of stress of just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, to like in that day and just
totally.
Have,
I mean, I think that is one of the things to go back to Strike World, but I think that is another one of the things that we're fighting for is this ability that like this ability to have a career that is not, that doesn't exist with massive pauses in between jobs, you know, like for writers, you know, having the room size, the room duration go on longer is critical for us to have job stability, to turn this career path into something that can be stable for anybody that chooses to do it. Of course, you know, of course, for both writers and actors, like it takes a tremendous amount of work, you know, like the iceberg imagery comes to mind where it's like all anybody ever really sees is the tip of the iceberg. They don't see the massive amount of like clawing and just climbing that you have to do to get to your one line on a show, I had a meeting with X company, you know, like to get there, like it takes a tremendous amount of work. And I don't think that the strike is about saying it shouldn't take that amount of work. I think it's about saying if we are putting in that amount of work, it needs to be, the returns need to be consistent, right? I think it's easy. You know, I just talked about flying first class and getting champagne. That was 1 6 hours of my life. The other part of it is scrambling, trying to find what my next job is going to be. The other part of it is getting absolutely fucked by a production company that is not paying me fairly for the amount of work that I've had to put in on a project. Is negotiating back and forth with how much do I deserve based off how famous I am. You know, like that, they don't say it in terms like that, but that is essentially what it is. Like my worth shouldn't be how public I am, you know, my worth shouldn't be dictated by, it shouldn't even really be dictated by how good you are. Good is a subjective thing. You know, I can say, you know, I think this writer is better than this writer. I think this actor is better than this actor, but that's like my opinion, you know?
Right.
And to somebody else, you know, I like one of my, one of my like favorite things that's ever been said to me, when I was doing Find Him as a solo show for Ars Nova during COVID, I made a 4-episode docu series with them. And then I was for a different theater company, like a year later, I was at a like mixer for writers and like financiers of the theater, which is essentially just something that this theater institution does to like create synergy. I think it's a wholly good thing of like creating synergy between like, these are the people that are, you know, pulling the curtain behind, you know, like these are the people that are donating and stuff or whatever. And I was sitting with this guy and he was like, you look really familiar to me. And I was like, oh, I don't know. Cause nothing's more embarrassing than when someone's like, you look really familiar to me, and being like, did you watch Find Him? And then being like, no. Just like, oh.
Well then.
That actually has happened to me where I was like, Find Him. And they were like, no, I think we go to the same grocery store. And I was like, great. But anyway, this guy was like,
you were in the rabbit aisle.
Did you do
rabbit food aisle? You were getting rabbit.
Yeah, exactly. I was getting rabbit. He was like, did you do Find Him for Ars Nova's online thing that they did in pandemic? And I was like, yeah, I did. And then he was like, yeah, I remember watching that and thinking, man, this is just not for me. But I hear the live show is really good, is what he said after. He said, man, this is just not for me, but I hear the live show is really good. And there's
but that I'm comma.
Like, yeah.
Oh, I love that.
I'm like, fuck you, how dare you? But then there's another part of me that's like, yes.
What are you supposed to do with that information?
This work wasn't for you. well, that's separate. But it's just like, you know, I think there's a point where we all have to just like come to terms with like, yeah, we're not making work for everyone. The truth of the matter is that like we are not creating things that are for everyone. And just connecting it back to Strike, because it's the only thing I can talk about because I'm a robot like that. I'm AI, guys. Surprise. it is that like this can't be an industry that's dictated by subjective things, which is sort of me talking about the celebrity of it all.
For sure, man.
So Dylan, on the strike, you said you're in day 80 something now, right?
Yeah, it's like 87.
So where are things now? Or do we have any idea?
Things are complicated. You know, there are things are complicated as far as, you know, this is the A number one question that I get from my family, you know, like when? And the answer is truly, the answer is, I don't know. I mean, if I look at the facts, right, the ANPTP put out an article on Deadline, right, that was like, we want them to lose their homes, and that completely backfired. And then they were like, and they're like, who said that? You know? And then they put out like that other thing about how it was brief. It was like, it didn't make traction because it was factually inaccurate, but it was about how writers made more cumulatively in the last like 2 years than they had in the last like years, whatever it was before that. But that's the article wasn't counting for the amount of people that come into this line of work and the amount of shows that are being produced. It's not, it's like, of course everyone's making more, but they're also like, as an industry, it actually, you're making more is actually what this article is saying. And yet you're not, you know, and so that also backfired. And I don't think that they would be putting out this sort of publication. And I don't think they would be putting out this press if there wasn't some form of scrambling on their part. That's speculative on my end, of course. I'm not saying like, and they're obviously scrambling, but you know, there is that. And now we have SAG as support. So I think, you know, live from the picket lines is morale is high. You know, personally, I'm like, I have that itch of when will I be able to work again? And I could say September, I could say October, I could say January. Like the truth is like, we don't know because we're waiting for them to come back to the table to negotiate with us. We're here. Like we are. And I know it's the same with SAG. Like we're here. We are ready to negotiate.
The thing with like actors is it's like, it's not even like, oh, I can't wait to get back to work. It's, oh, I can't even wait to get back to maybe having the opportunity to audition for work. You know what totally. I mean? Like, obviously, totally. Look, there's a bunch of series regulars and, you know, but like,
No. But,
films that are in production right. And all that stuff. But like, so much of the majority of actors is like, one audition at a time, man. You know, like you're know, just waiting for those I'm emails to come in where like you get to audition. And that's not everyone's story, obviously, but the majority of totally. People, it's like,
and I'm not super familiar with SAG's strike, like all of their terms. I know some of them, but isn't there one on audition? Isn't there something for auditioning in the terms of the strike?
We're trying to like, there's like some talk of trying to get, audition be paid
right like, right
and okay, and then look,
that's a hard no
yeah
if they're gonna okay here's the thing if they have to pay you to audition there's gonna be a lot less auditions doesn't that right. just seem like for fucking sure. like because a casting office can call in 200 people so then they have to clear that with like hey, producers, right. we're just going to, like, the producers don't care about all those auditions. They're like, give us the first, you know, the top three. We'll have a look at them and, you know, but like, so, okay, we're going to pay for how many fucking people? That's never going to happen. You're going to see way lower auditions and then you're going to go, hey, why am I not auditioning? Because they don't want to fucking pay you.
Yeah. Yes.
I think it's insane. Yeah.
No, it's all, you know, it's for sure. tricky. It's hard
there's also speak. Like,
I am not as informed because I've been deep in WGA land, but you know, I do believe that we'll get what we want on both sides. I do believe that they need us more than we need them. And I do believe that this will like, it will end. One thing that we do know is that the strike will, it has to end. We'll definitely hit 100 days. I would be shocked if we didn't.
The last writer's strike was 90 days. Is that correct?
It was 100. It was 100. Exactly
100. 100. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, 100 is when. So, what? Something that I'm anticipating seeing, and I don't want to go into all the terminology because we don't need to. And if you're listening, I would advise, like, if I'm saying a term that you don't know, look it up. But force majeure starts at 100 days for studios. So,
I love that movie.
Yeah, it starts at 100.
I love that movie.
So we'll see what we can anticipate seeing most likely is overalls ending at a lot of studios. This is all highly speculative. None of this is coming from me having any sort of intel or information, but beyond, you know, what's publicly out there. But it's been reported that the AMPTP didn't want a strike in the same way that we wanted our fair contracts and were willing to strike for our fair contracts. I think they wanted it. It's specifically to get out of a lot of these overalls. So I think until AMPTP has some leverage in that department, I don't think that they'll come back to the negotiating table. That's me and my opinion. But I think that once they do, you know, I don't think that any on either side, I know for a fact the Writers Guild isn't doing this, but I don't think that the AMPTP is just sort of like sitting around twiddling their thumbs. Like, I think they know what they're going to come to the table with. They're just waiting to come to the table. Because I can't imagine at day 87, they have zero clue, you know, what they're going to negotiate back. It's just a particular sort of gridlock stalemate that's happening. And so I'd say morale is great. I would say come to the pickets. I'm organizing one for playwrights August 16th. It's going to be really fun. We have a really wonderful DJ, but I like, you know, and I, it's funny to talk on the same hand of like, we're fighting for a fair contract and being like, come party with us. And because it is, but it is like, it is that, like, it does need, I am a big believer that like, it does need to be that, because that's the only way we're going to get through it. What are we supposed to like, hold a candle and be wearing like a black veil and walking back and forth in a circle, like singing a dirge? No, we can't.
It's plus we're artists. We're charismatic people that are just trying to like exert our energy and be like the people that we are born to be, which is just
totally
artists. Just like, let's go. Let's have fun with this all, you know, to just, be like, as if we're walking, like mourning the loss of our jobs. It's like, yes, we are doing that inside when we go home and lay our heads down at night. But at the end, during the day, we're out here trying to just like, get our voices heard and show that we are like in solidarity with one another and we're going to be okay. And we do that by fucking throwing DJ parties and fucking taking our shirts off and fucking waving them around our head like a helicopter, baby. Come on.
Exactly. I love when it rains with the pickets and we're all just like, we're in the rain, you know, it does. There's also during the production shutdowns, there was also a sort of like, it was a feeling I felt like I had never felt before. There were 12 of us that shut down. It was probably more than 12. It was like maybe at any point during the day, it was like a maximum of 20 people, but we probably had like 60 people circle in and out, but we shut down Billions and it was one of the last Billions shut down. And there was like 15 of us when it actually got shut down. And it was the first one that I had been part of that actively like worked. And it was my first captaining shift. And it was this like electric feeling of like, wow, we tangibly were able, you know, this was a tangible outcome. Like it was a activism is so weird because a lot of the times we're fighting for these, how do I phrase this? Like with the Women's March in the 2016 election, that's the best example that I have. It was this amazing display. It was so important. It was so vital. It really did change a lot of our zeitgeist, but we knew that we weren't going to like oust Donald Trump, you know, like,
yeah, it's like, how does that trickle down into like everyday behavior?
Totally. I was in, a lot of those marches. I worked for an activism organization throughout the 2016 election, but this in particular is a different type of feeling when it's like we actively cost the AMPTP $1 million in one day by shutting down this show.
I think, you know? Billions was the last TV show I auditioned for.
Oh, really? Oh, fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Billions.
Yeah. Yeah. So... Anyway, I think all that I'm saying is that like it does feel, there is this sort of strange electric feeling that I felt unmatched in other things that I've been part of. Not that it, by no means am I comparing it. I'm just saying like it is different. And I think now that productions are all shut down, now we're sort of moving into like the celebratory phase of picketing where it's like SAG's with us. We got this. We're in it. Like, there's a lot more food at pickets now than there was before. There's a lot more music. There's a lot more conversation happening. We're not chanting as much. We sort of like come into it there. And it's been going on for a really long time. So, yeah.
Are you prepared to stay in it for a long, like, let's say a year, hypothetically?
Yeah, luckily,
God, it's a fucking year.
I know it's not gonna go for a year, but luckily I did sell a movie shortly before the strike.
Congratulations!
Thank you.
You need some actors.
I do. I will, and I'm also directing it, which is cool.
But come on, indie movies.
Thank you. So luckily, the paycheck from that will carry me a little bit longer / like savings from I was a talk show host for a long time, and it paid me well. So I still have financially, you know, I was having a conversation earlier this morning where I was a bartender for a really long time, and I was like, do I go back to bartending? And there's a part of me that's like, in this strike time, is me getting a job like bartending, is that not what the strike is about? Is part of my duty to like not get a job? You know, like what is that negotiation? The only thing that I feel really comfortable doing is teaching. So I've been doing a lot of like workshoppy things and stuff like that. And I have like a theater life that isn't on hold. So like financially we're okay for the strike, as a round, but I will call you both if I need a place to stay. I mean, I don't know, truly to be High School Musical about it. Like, we are all in this together. Yellow High School Musical. We love it.
I don't even get the reference. Is it just why is that the reference for that?
It's a song, right?
Oh my god, it's a song.
Oh, yeah. I know, I'm the worst.
What the fuck?
I'm out. I'm just gonna see myself out.
Dylan, thank you so much for chatting with us today. This was super informative in so many ways, and I hope
thank you
people get a little bit more people get out of this, you know, what it's like on your guys's side, because obviously, you know, we're more on the actor's side, but you know, to get some insight from a writer and somebody in that world, and you know, there's a lot going on right now in the industry. Well, there's nothing going on in the industry. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us. You said you have what do you have coming up? You said you sold a film.
I mean, the film is not even in production yet, and it won't be until post strike. So
copy that. Okay.
But I have some theater stuff coming up. Behind me on this whiteboard, I'm drafting a play for MTC on scientists, on the scientist that designed the Arecibo message. Actually, I want to take like two more minutes because it is something that I just think is like fun and very sweet and really tripped me out. I've been meeting with some like NASA scientists to talk about the conception of the Arecibo message, because I'm writing this play for this theater that's about this telescope in Puerto Rico and the one true time we try to contact alien life, but not really. Anyway, and I was talking to them about the message, and I was like, so can you like walk me through how a message like this would be designed? And they were like, yeah. So it was like a team of like eight of us would like meet in a room, and then we would just like bounce ideas off of what, and then of like what should go in this message. And I was like,
A writer's room.
I was like, holy, because I've pushed the deadline on this like three times for this play because I've been so nervous to write science. And then I had this meeting and I was like, wait.
Relatable content. And they're like, oh my god, the first time they flew us out to all meet and I got fucking wasted on champagne and then I had rabbit, and you're like, what?
Yeah, thank you guys so much, this was so fun.
What a trip.
Thank you, this was so cool. Thank you for joining us, and you know, god, now I'm gonna quote that fucking High School Musical, we are all in this together.
We are, it's true, you know.
Listen, I'm gonna quote it too, just because I dropped the ball last time. We are all in this together, guys. Yeah.
And maybe we'll see you out on the picket lines.
You will. You will for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, come. There's a playwrights picket August 16th. There's a young writers picket on Tuesday. There are things that are happening. It's going to be fun.
Sweet. And if people want to find you online, where can they do that?
Oh, yeah. You can follow me on Instagram @DylanGuerra or on Twitter @DylanGGuerra. My social security number. No. That's where I'm at.
My Venmo is.
My Venmo is at Dylan Guerra-1. The photo is the back of my head.
Drop some coin.
It's awesome, Dylan. You're it's always interesting to talk to people that are writers because you have such a like eloquent way of expressing yourself and you're so articulate. And I'm always envious of people who are concise, talk for like 13 minutes about a 30 second idea. really admirable, man.
Like,
I think you really have like expressed what it is like to be a working class person in this business right now in a really cool way that I think a lot of people that aren't in this business will be able to listen to and take away from. And that's really important, man. I admire you. I think your work is great. Can we see you like as an actor in certain things that you've done? Like,
you can find him in 3 hours. Yeah. Find him. Is hopefully it's in talks or something right now. as a live show soon. We will
see. The docuseries is anywhere?
I'm sorry?
Is the docuseries somewhere available?
I'm not actually sure if it's still available. It would be on Ars Nova Supra, but I think they only optioned the rights for a year. So I don't know that it's still up, but you can watch it there. It's fun. It's weird.
Yeah, I feel like you'd be a really fun actor to watch as well.
Oh, thank you.
Outside of your...
And you're great. You were so great in your episode. I said that before, but...
I'm just embracing my aesthetic and being just fucking douchebag.
Hey, what's the second word in typecast? Cast.
Yeah.
So who gives a shit?
Okay, Adam. Okay.
You know, you go to like colleges and they're like, I don't want to be typecast.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. You don't want to work? Like, cast. Let's get cast.
Grateful. That was a really, really fun project to be a part of. You guys are the best. On that set, I had food poisoning while I was shooting. So I was like going both ways. Yeah, like getting called on the walkies, like saying we got a 20 on Julian. I'm fucking in the
he's 10-1 again.
Cafeteria bathroom, just like it was gnarly, dude. They brought waffles and binges to us because it was like the last day of shooting, and I think that must have done it, man, because I just slammed one of those bad boys and I was like, oh my God. And for like the whole night. Yeah, it was just, it was gnarly, but it was great.
Sorry about that. But I'm so glad that I could hear it here.
Dylan, thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Later, brother. See you on the picket lines.
Yes.
Awesome,
right.
Man.
Talk later.
See ya. That was great.
I really like him, man. I feel like I want to like kind of. He's like a guy I want to be friends with.
Yeah,
I hang out.
Yeah, that was so cool. You know, everything that's going on to have something to have someone from that arena. Was so informative and. You know, his story about how where he got to where he got is not really what I was expecting. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know. It's kind of like for a lot of actors, there isn't a, you can make a game plan, but it's just, it truly is different for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you ask people like, hey, how do you, it's like, well, I mean, I give you pointers, but like, it's not going to be the same for everyone, you know?
There's absolutely no formula whatsoever to this business. And I think like, if you do have advice for youngsters that are getting into this business or just people that are wanting to get in it at any point, it's just like, I can tell you what not to do, but I can't really tell you what to do, you know, because there is just no right way. It's not necessarily linear at all. And so what works for me, not necessarily going to work for you. And he has a really cool story into that thing. And I know it kind of sounds like when he's talking, we consolidated it into an hour plus episode. And it sounds kind of like, wow, that all really happened really fast for you. But it's never that case. He's talking about playwriting at 16. And so it's just like, it's a long, arduous process. And it keeps moving, man. And, you know, eventually you know, 5 years from now, you're going to hear his name and be like, oh my God, dude, like that guy, where'd he come from? All of a sudden, dude, overnight success. Yeah. It's like, no way, dude. He's been working.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, when you're between jobs and, you know, auditioning or, you know, even what he does, it's like when you're not really, really in it, like with a, you know, weeks feel like months.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, you know, there was a year or two where you were. Yeah. And it felt like a fucking decade.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's time is different when you're, when things aren't solidified for you. And yeah. It's, you know.
Yeah.
The yeah. Yeah. Anyway, great episode.
Great episode, man. Garrett, what a guy.
Yeah. So everyone, you can find out more about Before the Break and how to become a working actor at workingactorpro.com. Follow us on Instagram at Before the Break Pod and Working Actor Pro. You can follow us on Twitter at B4. That's the number 4. The Break Pod. Follow us on TikTok at Before the Break Pod. Check out my stuff at adamdecarlo.com and follow me at that Adam DeCarlo. You can check out Tom's stuff at the Tom Downing and follow him at I'm Tom, by the way. Follow Julian at Julian Gavilanes. Don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a rating, and write a review if you like what you hear. Check back next week for an all-new episode with an all-new guest. See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to Before the Break. The hosts are Tommy Beardmore and Adam DeCarlo. Cover art by Amanda June Boucher. Music by Benjamin Sturley. Before the Break is recorded live from Los Angeles and New York City.